Good evening. If y'all would take out your Bibles and turn to the book of Hebrews. It's been a little while since we've walked through a text together, and I've been excited to start this study with y'all. I think Scott had done kind of an overview on Hebrews a few weeks ago and mentioned that I'd been working on Hebrews. Sometimes that's the way it goes. You've been working on something, and then the other preacher, you know, preaches on it. It's a blessing to be with you all. I'm grateful for everybody who's here tonight. We're going to talk tonight, we'll get into the text a little bit, hopefully, but we're going to mainly try to ask a few questions as we get the background of Hebrews. It's an interesting book. Even among the books of the New Testament, it has some unique things to it, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into the text this afternoon. We're going to ask five questions as we begin the background and introduction to Hebrews. We're going to ask who wrote it, who was it written to, why was it written, what's in it, and specifically, what's in it for me? Not just the content of the book, but how can I be applying this? How is this going to be helpful to my walk with the Lord? And we'll begin with maybe the biggest question about the book of Hebrews is, who wrote it? I'm going to give you a revelation tonight. We don't know. And after all these years, the book has been around, we still don't know. A lot of people have put together a lot of conjectures about who might have written the book of Hebrews, but we really don't know. The Lord knows, and I'm grateful that He does, and He apparently saw fit that we didn't need to know, and so it doesn't negate the inspiration of the book. I'll put up some things that people have speculated. We're not going to spend a lot of time here tonight. Of course, the obvious question is, well, Paul. I mean, he wrote all these other books in the New Testament. But of course, all of Paul's other letters, if he did write Hebrews, begin with the word Paul. And it's conspicuously absent. There is no name attached to the book of Hebrews. It's also written in a different style. There are some similarities to Hebrews and the other letters that Paul wrote, but there's a lot of difference in just the style. Even in just some of the vocabulary that he uses, a lot of times the Hebrew writer, whoever they may have been, just calls Jesus, Jesus. Most of the time, Paul says Christ Jesus or Jesus Christ. One of Paul's favorite phrases, in Christ or in Him, or those kinds of things that you see throughout Paul's letters, it's very, very rare in the book of Hebrews. So there's some basic things stylistically that when you've been listening to somebody for a while, you can kind of tell that doesn't sound like them. So if it is Paul, it's a very different style for him. Some people have put forward Apollos, since he was an eloquent man, mighty in the scriptures, and may have been in a position to write a letter like this, but really we have nothing to go on there. We don't have any other writing from Apollos, and there's no early attestation. This book has not really been connected to Apollos by those who may have been in a better position to know than we are. Some people have put forward the idea that Luke wrote it. There are some similarities in the kind of the I forget the actual word for this, but the level of Greek, Luke's Greek is considered to be finer Greek than Paul's writing, and Hebrews is considered to be one of the finest piece of Greek works in the New Testament. And so it might say, well, it's kind of on a higher level, maybe Luke wrote it. But again, there is some similar style, but it's not really sufficient evidence, and Luke was a Gentile. And so of all things, for a Gentile to be writing this letter to the Hebrews doesn't make a lot of sense. Some people have put forward Silas because some people attribute the similarity to Paul's style as, well, the author of Hebrews knew Paul really well and was familiar with Paul's writing and his works, and so they kind of, that's why it sounds a little bit like Paul, but not really. Silas would be in a good position to know that, but this is really just a guess. We have even less to go on, perhaps, with this. One, I think, of the ones we can guess this might hold the most water is Barnabas. He was a Levite, a native of Cyprus, and so that would put him in a really good position to know about the types of things he's writing about. There's that phrase at the end, bear with this word of exhortation. He's called the son of exhortation. So it could be Barnabas, but again, we just have very little to really nail that down. So I don't think we should be dogmatic about who wrote Hebrews. It's also kind of interesting, I've read this, that if he was serving in the temple, why is the temple never referred to? In the book of Hebrews. You'd think that would be kind of an obvious thing. They use the tabernacle in the book, which is kind of interesting. So lots of questions there, but the conclusion for our purposes is this does not affect the inspiration of this book. It is consistent with the message of the New Testament and other places in the Scripture. And I believe we can be sure that this book is from God, and that we can trust what it says, even though we don't know the human author. Just a side note, you'll note that in your New Testament, Hebrews is kind of placed in the New Testament order, because you've got like the Gospels and Acts, and then you've got all of Paul's letters. And Hebrews put right there at the end of Paul's letters and at the beginning of the what we might call the general epistles. And so it's kind of like, well, it could go with Paul's letters, it could go over here. And so it's kind of, I don't know if that was intentional, that it was kind of strategically placed in the New Testament to be kind of ambiguous as to who wrote it, because we don't know. Who is it written to? As we look at the content of Hebrews, it's a little bit like when you look at the content of the different Gospels. You can tell by what the author brings out the audience that he's really aiming for. And which of the four Gospels can we tell was written primarily to a Jewish audience? I mean, Matthew. And why is that? It is just so full of Old Testament references. This happened to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet. And then he'll quote from it. And so much of Matthew is just constructed in such a way to make sense to a Jew, somebody who knew the Old Testament and was looking for that. And Hebrews, of course, maybe one of the, at least of the letters, Revelation has probably more Old Testament references than Hebrews does. But as far as the letters go, Hebrews is about the most Old Testament-y letter that we have. And very likely written to Jews. It just wouldn't make sense, really, for the author to be so heavily relying on an understanding of the Old Testament scriptures if his audience was not, at least, primarily Jewish. Also, the content is that it is written to people who are already Christians. He talks about holding fast to their confession, not turning back. And so it's written to Christians. So that's really the main thing we know about the audience. It's not written to... it doesn't name like a certain church in a certain place. And there's a lot of debate over the specifics here, but it is Jewish Christians that he's writing to. And we'll talk more about the why in just a minute. It is notable that if you look in Hebrews 13, 23, in some of the closing remarks in this letter, the author says, take notice that our brother Timothy has been released, with whom, if he comes soon, I will see you. It sounds like this may have been written to a specific place. It doesn't say where, but this could have been a particular local congregation. From the little bit that I've read, it sounds like it fits best perhaps a church in Judea, maybe a church in Jerusalem. Some people have speculated Rome because of the verse 24, those from Italy greet you. But there's not enough detail on that little phrase to know whether he was writing from Italy or to Italy or just there are people from Italy with him when he wrote. So we don't have a lot to go on there. But perhaps an audience of Jewish Christians in Judea, perhaps. Part of the reason for that is because of the type of persecution that they seem to be facing, which was likely from other Jews. It is notable that as we look through Hebrews, there are some specific problems that the author seems to know about the group. In chapter 5, in the beginning of chapter 6, he kind of comes down pretty hard on them and saying, by this time, you ought to be teachers. He knows them well enough to know you've been a Christian long enough to be doing better than you're doing. And you look in chapter 10, and he says, you remember the former days when you endured this type of persecution, and now you're going through another persecution again? He knows the background of his audience. He doesn't name them, but he's close to them. In chapter 13, with some of the specific things about remembering those who are in prison and keeping your character free from the love of money, he knows his audience. We don't know who is writing, who exactly is being written to, but we know that they know each other, and that's what's going on. And this is, again, likely Judeans facing persecution from fellow Jews. If you'd like to talk sometime about the other ideas behind that, there's some different reasons for that. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time tonight on that. So why was it written? And I think as we look at any book of the Bible, this is a really important question to ask. Because you can understand like the content of a book, but until we understand the purpose of a book, I think that we're kind of limited in making some of the applications that we need to make. So as we think about this, I want to ask a question. And this is there's a little bit of semantics in this, so roll with me on this. But were the Jews being tempted to return to Judaism? And think about that question for a minute. I think the answer to this really, because this is usually what we hear, is, oh, the Hebrews is written because the Jews were being tempted to turn back to Judaism. And there's a sense in which that's true. But I want to illustrate it this way. The Jews would have been practicing Judaism up until the point of their conversion in their life. And the way that I've always kind of used to think about this is it looked kind of like this. As they're practicing Jew, they're a Jew, they're a Jew, they're a Jew, and then they hear about Jesus and boom! Now they're a Christian. And what they're being tempted to do is they're just like, they've kind of jumped the tracks, and now they're being tempted to jump the tracks again and go back to Judaism. But during this period right here, they were just being a Christian, and they like stopped doing all the Jewish stuff. But is that what we see in the New Testament? When you look at in Acts 21, we were just studying this at the Chick-fil-A study recently, the Jews didn't stop being Jews when they were converted. And in fact, that was what was the rumor was that was being circulated about Paul. When he got back to Jerusalem, James and the elders say, hey, Paul, do you hear what they're saying about you? They say, you're going out there and you're telling Jews to stop circumcising their kids, to stop following the law of Moses, to just abandon Judaism. And Paul went way out of his way and made some big sacrifices, literally and metaphorically, to show that, no, that's not what I'm teaching. Jews, that's fine for Jews to keep being Jews. But the question at hand was, do the Gentiles have to become Jews to practice Christianity? And the overwhelming answer in the New Testament is no, they don't. So what is the model? It kind of looks something more like this. These were practicing Jews, and when they were converted, they were also Christians. They were still practicing their Jewish things. But I will say that they would have had a changed perspective on Judaism. And that's one of the things that Hebrews is really trying to encourage them to think about is, yes, you're a Jew, yes, you're going to the temple, yes, you're doing these things, but you need to realize that all this Old Testament stuff is a shadow. You've got the partial, but now you've got the full, so don't let go. Don't let go, is what he's trying to tell them. So the warning, really, is that this would happen. And that they're going to be Christians for a while, and this is the problem that's being addressed. Hold fast your confession. Don't give up. Don't turn back. I mean, they were still living this way, but it would have been more comfortable for them with the persecution they're facing just to kind of let go of Christ and just go back to their Jewish ways and trust in that for salvation. So I hope that makes sense. That was something that, until kind of preparing for this, I don't know if I grasped that, but I think that's helpful to articulate that, especially as we're looking through Acts and other places in the New Testament. There's two motivations that he's giving. Again, this is something why he's writing. He's trying to prevent this from happening, from them from falling away from Christ. And he uses two kind of ways of doing it. The first is just kind of outright rebuke and encouragement. There's parts of the books where he says, you guys need to wake up. You guys need to grow up. You guys need to fix things. But then a lot of the book is written, and it's kind of these concepts. He's saying, look at who Jesus is. Look at how much better he is than these things from Judaism and the Old Testament. And they point to Jesus. These aren't bad things. But look at how much better what you have is. And I think this is really important for us to see, because sometimes I think our Bible study can kind of, I don't know if degenerate is the right word, but it can kind of become this collection of facts, and we have this understanding about different things. But Hebrews is a really cool book to show how learning about sometimes technical and complicated things, but learning about who God is and how He works and what He's done gets translated into, now here's what you're supposed to do about it. One of the phrases that we see in there is, therefore, since we have this or that or the other, let us do this thing. And so I really think that's a cool feature of the book of Hebrews, how he's motivating these people is he's giving them a better understanding, not just so they can be so smart, but so that they'll live differently because of that. And that's a connection we all need to make. So what's in the book of Hebrews? This is a kind of a side note, but I think it's kind of interesting, is that there are some things about the book of Hebrews is that it bears the marks of an oral delivery, which is just a sermon that somebody kind of spoke it Some people have argued, well, it's really too, the Greek is just too good for it to be a transcript. That, like, somebody just preached this sermon and then somebody wrote it down and then they slapped a conclusion on it and said, oh, now it's a letter, and then sent it off. It bears some marks of oral delivery. A notable thing about that is in Acts 13:15, and we made reference to this, is that in the synagogue there at Antioch and Pisidia, they said, if any of you has a word of encouragement, let him say it. And that's the same phrase that's used at the end of Hebrews when he says, bear with this word of encouragement, basically. And so that may have been really their way of saying sermon, essentially. If anybody has a sermon, if anybody has something to say, let them say it. So bear with this sermon, basically. And there are a lot of things in the book of Hebrews, just the style, like he'll quote a text, and then he'll just kind of go through it, and he'll use parts of the text as he's going through, which is really like regular preaching, right? As we take a text, we break it down, and you keep quoting from the text, which if it was just a letter, you wouldn't necessarily have to keep writing it down again and writing it down again. It's like, you can see it, it's right there. But so it sounds more like a sermon. But there are also things that make it look like a letter. In the very same verse where he says there in 13:22, but I urge you, brethren, bear with this word of exhortation, for I have written to you briefly. I don't think that's what he would have been saying in the sermon. And so it's kind of interesting that you kind of, Hebrews is unique in the sense that it sounds more like a sermon, but it's also kind of like a letter. So it may have just been that this was a kind of a sermon that wasn't orally delivered exactly, but it was written in that form. And it was sent as a letter and maybe intended to be read out loud and to come across kind of in that sermon form. So Hebrews is unique in the New Testament. Although I will say, I think I had read 1 John also. There's some, not as strong as Hebrews, but it could have been more of like a sermon type thing. The structure of Hebrews, this is a really tricky thing. Hebrews is one of those books that if you pick up, if you get like 3, 4, or 5 different commentaries on Hebrews and you look at the outline that the commentators do, you'll probably find 4 or 5 different outlines. There's some basic things that are the same, but it's hard to like nail down exactly where all the divisions are in the book of Hebrews. I'm going to put one option up here for your consideration, but just know that there are different ways to do this. We're going to look at the kind of break it down into 5 different sections, basically. The first section is chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 18, so the first 2 chapters. It's the superiority of Jesus, of the Son, and the superiority of His message. It's a better message, it's a better messenger. The second section would be chapter 3 and 4, or at least the first part of chapter 4. And it's the need for endurance to reach God's rest. And there's the whole exposition on Psalm 95 in this section. The third section is by far the longest, and that begins in the end of chapter 4, where Jesus is introduced as the high priest. And that section, in some ways, really takes us all the way through chapter 10, as he's exploring the different dimensions of Jesus' priesthood. It's like Melchizedek. It's better than the sacrifices and the other elements of the priesthood. So that's kind of a high priestly section when you take it all together. There's a lot more subdivisions than that, but we're just kind of sticking to the overview this afternoon. The fourth section is kind of like the section before, in that there's a need for endurance again, and to obtain the promises that God's given, chapter 11 and chapter 12, God's discipline, the examples of faith that we have there. And chapter 13 comes back to our relationships with our brethren, and there's a conclusion at the end of that chapter. But what this does is it creates a structure, that we've talked a little bit about this in our lessons here. The fancy word for it is it's a chiasm, but you might just look at it as it's like a mirrored structure. And this is something that was pretty common in ancient times. A way of that they would teach is they would go through some points and kind of get to their main point, and then they would kind of backtrack and go backwards through the points. And you'll see this in a lot of different ways. This is a very loose one. Some of these are more exact than others. There's some that you're like, wow, like that's really cool. The book of Daniel has a really cool big one of these in chapters 2 through 7, I think it is, if you look at the book of Daniel. But that one's pretty strong. But just for our learning purposes this afternoon, I thought that was pretty cool. And that the center point of this structure, the emphasized point is the point in the middle, and that's Jesus' high priesthood is kind of one of the big main points of Hebrews. So we want to ask the question, what's in it for me? That's great that these Jewish Christians were having those problems like a long time ago, but guess what? I'm not a Jewish Christian. I don't think we have any Jewish Christians here tonight. So why should we study this book? Well, here's the thing. We face the same things that our brethren faced, our Jewish brethren in the first century. Have you ever found yourself drifting? That's what they're facing. Have you ever realized that you've become hardened in your heart and you need to be softened and need to start listening again? Encourage one another day after day so that you all be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Have you ever been tempted to quit and really thought, you know, this is just too hard? There's so many things coming at me right now. Guess what? Same temptation that our brethren were facing in this book. Have you ever just been tired of all the pressure that's on you? Consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Let me tell you, if you haven't faced those things, you will. All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. We're going to face pressure. And the book of Hebrews is a very helpful book for the kinds of things that we are facing, and I believe the kinds of things that we will probably be increasingly facing in this country, in this place. And so this is a really important book for us to understand why it's written and to just embrace its message, to be motivated by the same things that motivated our brethren who are facing a lot worse things than we're facing right now. We need the same motivation. We need the same rebuke and encouragement. And again, this idea of practical learning. These were just four places in the book that I found this construction. I mentioned it earlier. Therefore, since this, let us this. And so this is a really cool pattern to look for as we're going through the book. And again, what he's doing there is he's kind of gone into some stuff and it's like, okay, you know, if I lost you on that, by the way, this is the application of that. Understand this so you can live it. And guys, if our study doesn't have that live it part to it, we need to dig deeper. So let's look at the book of Hebrews. We're just going to get into the first three verses tonight, but as with several other letters in the New Testament, Hebrews begins with a bang. It just starts at about 1,000 miles an hour. So we're going to look at the first three verses this afternoon for our learning. Read with me, Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to our fathers in the prophets, in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory, and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And that sentence kind of continues into his first main point about Jesus being greater than the angels. We're just going to look at these first three verses for right now, and we'll cover the transition next time, Lord willing. So the book begins with answering a critical, critical question. How has God spoken to us? If you talk with people for very long, you realize how important of a question this is. Because if we disagree on this question, then we don't really have a basis to have a logical discussion and everything after that. And so he begins from the very start and is establishing authority. And is saying this is the credible source. And he contrasts two different things. He's going to immediately start referencing our fathers. So he's talking to these Jewish people and the things they would have already understood, and he's going to show how in four different ways Jesus, in some ways, is superior in this. The first is the time frame. Do you notice what was the time frame from the Old Testament? God, after he spoke, long ago. And what's the contrast to that? Has in these last days spoken to us through his Son. So it's like God said some things a long time ago. there was a long, long time ago, a God whose voice the prophets heard. You know, he is the God that we should know who speaks through his inspired word. In these last days, he's spoken to us in his Son. In the recipients, he spoke long ago to the fathers. And again, these have to be Jews as he's talking about their fathers. But in these last days, he's spoken to us. The agent, how, through whom did God speak to the fathers? Through the prophets. But in these last days, he's spoken to us through his Son. And you think about that. That's pretty amazing. God was using different people in times past to convey his message to people, but they were still servants. But now God is speaking not just through one of his servants, but through his only Son. How much more should these Jewish Christians, and how much more should we listen because of the messenger? And the manner. How did God do it in days gone by? As in many ways. And you can think about what many ways did he use to speak. I mean, sometimes it would be through a dream, sometimes it would be through a donkey, sometimes it would be through a prophet, sometimes, you know, there are all sorts of different ways that God would speak to his people in those days. But in these last days, he's spoken to us in his Son. So there, if you're a chart person, I like charts, there's your four contrasts right off the bat. This is like the first two verses of the book, and he's already like made 4 points. Like, look at the superiority of what you have based on what you've had in the past. The last days, I'll just make a side note about this. I believe what he's talking about here is the Christian era. Sometimes we say the Christian dispensation. Isaiah 2, in the last days it will come about, the mountain of the Lord will be exalted to the highest of the mountains. Acts 2:17, the Joel quote that's quoted about the day of Pentecost, says it will come about in the last days that your young men see dreams, old men prophesy, those things. 2 Timothy 3:1, but remember that in the last days, you know, these bad things are going to happen, false doctrine and things like that. So when you see that phrase, think we are in the last days. The people that he was writing to are in the last days. He says, in these last days, he's spoken to us in his Son. And I think just the idea of the last days is that it's, God's done the other things he's going to do, and we're waiting for him to come back and to wrap this thing up. So look at this next section. After those four contrasts that he makes, he lists 6 different descriptions of Jesus. He, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world, and he is the radiance of his glory, and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power, and when he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. That's kind of 2 in the last one, but I want us to see the structure here, because I think this is also kind of a mirrored structure when you look at it, and you think about this. He's appointed heir of all things, it's his exalted position, through whom he made the world, it's his role in creation. He's the radiance of God's glory, it's his relation to God, and that's kind of his main point here, and then he does it in reverse. He says he's the exact representation of his nature. Same thing, relation to God. He upholds all things by the word of his power, his role in creation, and he made purification for sins and sat down at the right hand of power, his exalted position. Sorry for OCD people, because I did ran out of room right there on the chart. But do you see this, what he's saying about the Son? He is in the highest position that you can have. He is the heir of all things. He's the Son of God, and as a Son, all things are kind of being prepared for him. That's why all this is going on. He's going to inherit all these things when it's all said and done. And at the end, he has made purification for sins, and he sits down at the right hand of God. There is no higher position. When you kind of move one step inward, through whom he made the world. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, and without him nothing came into being that has come into being. Jesus is the agent through which God created the world, and more than that, he upholds all things by the word of his power. There's a lot there that I don't know if we can even wrap our minds around right now, but suffice it to say, like, we're sitting here like stuck to this rock hurtling through space in perfect orbit around the sun, which is orbiting around, you know, and you look at this. This universe is being held together by God's power. And if he were to stop, we would just be dead. He upholds all things by the word of his power. It's like how God created in the beginning, right? With his words. He created with his words. He's upholding it by his words. But I want us to really think on this middle section. Have you ever wanted to meet God? Have you ever wanted to like, well, what if like I could see him all of a sudden, you know, and like he kind of came out of hiding and he was visible and I could like watch him and I could talk with him and I could see his reaction in different situations? Because sometimes it's hard, isn't it? Because we can't see God. And it's hard for us to, how do I have a relationship with a being that I can't see? And here's the thing. If you know Jesus, you've seen God. And that really, when you stop to think about that, that's amazing. That God would do that for us is that in Jesus, God is becoming flesh. And he's not just like kind of like God, you know, like he's his son, but like he's kind of different than his dad, you know, like they have some... No, like he is the radiance of his glory. The glory of the Father is represented in the glory of the Son. We beheld his glory full of grace and truth. He is the exact representation of his nature. There's nothing that's like in the Father that's not like in the Son. When you see Jesus, I mean, isn't that what Jesus said when Thomas asked, no, show us the Father. And he says, if you've seen me, you have seen the Father. That's really amazing when we stop to think about that and the practical implications of that. We know what God is like. There is no greater revelation of who God is, what he wants, and how we should be than in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And man, I don't know about you, but when you really think about that, like I need to go read the Gospels like 5 times a day. You know, like I just need to absorb, like, who is this Jesus? Because if I can understand him, I can understand God. He is the best bridge that we have, really the only bridge that we have to God. So lots of things to think about in this. I just think that's a cool structural thing. And again, I mean, we're only in the first 3 verses. We're already into all of these things. Lots to think about. Some other things to notice about this that I think are really cool. One is that you see different roles of Jesus that are kind of insinuated in this first section. When he made purification for sins, what Old Testament role do you think the Jews would have thought about? He's the priest, right? He's the one who's making propitiation for sins. When he sat down at the right hand of power, what's kind of the role of Jesus there? He's the king, right? And already that we talked about, this is kind of the last section we talked about. In these last days, he's done what? Spoken to us through his son. What role is that? He's prophet, and he's priest, and he's king. And that's pretty cool. Again, just like right there in the first little bit, he's the prophet, priest, and king. These three great roles of the Old Testament all rolled into one, which is really cool. I remember, I believe it was Marty Pickup. I was listening to a series that he was doing, and he was talking about looking at early Jewish writings that a lot of times the Jews were confused about there being multiple messiahs coming. Like, one of them was going to be the prophet like Moses, and one of them was going to be the suffering servant, and one of them was going to be the king like David, and all these different things. And they didn't realize until after all this was revealed that it's one guy. You know, he fulfills all of the roles of the Old Testament. All of the prophecies find their fulfillment in Jesus. So this is just cool right at the beginning of Hebrews. He's the prophet, he's the priest, he's the king. One other dimension of this that's kind of interesting is that you see that through whom he made the world, his role in the past from the very beginning, he upholds all things by the word of his power, is the present, and he is appointed heir of all things, kind of looking forward to the future. So you see also kind of the past, present, and future in this first section of Hebrews. So what? What's the Hebrew writer's main point in just the first 3 verses? I'm just going to summarize it with a verse from the book of Mark. At the transfiguration, then a cloud formed overshadowing them, and a voice came out of the cloud. This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. I think that pretty well summarizes that very beginning of Hebrews. How has God spoken to us? Through his beloved Son. Let's listen to him. If you're here tonight and you need to respond to the gospel, you may need to listen to Jesus for the first time and become his servant. You have the opportunity to do that before we leave. And if you're here tonight, you've become discouraged or you need the help of the brethren here. If, like the Jewish Christians, you're being tempted to turn back or to give up, we want to help you and strengthen those hands and make those feeble knees strong again. If we can help you in any way, let us know while we stand and sing this song.